Can you even try and envision an existence without accessing internet technologies via your university or even a local cafe? Hey, could even be accessing it on public transport. Take yourself away from that and imagine being right smack bang in the middle of Central Australia and within your dusty off-road vehicle that's taken you right across the Stuart Highway. You are to be accosted by an entire outback community making a beeline for your very precious two-way radio, because this is the only communications device available to find out the prognosis of a family member's surgery. That story of one university researcher's extensive data extraction methods in finding out whether the government is doing its bit to close the gap in the accessing of online technologies within the most remote parts of Australia. Here on the show that looks at the media and communications industries every week on Community Radio, it's The Fourth Estate. Mick Caldwell here. Thanks so much for joining me as we look to what else we'll be hearing over the next half hour. Dylan Barber identifies the issues surrounding our right to keep a low profile in cyberspace. And Nathan Coates gets the no-holds-barred insight into the issues facing media workers who try and report from within the country's detention centres. So do stay tuned with me over the next half hour for these stories and more. It's The Fourth Estate. The Australian Press Council has just released a new set of standards outlining professional guidelines for media workers about suicide. Consulting with mental health workers and industry bodies such as Mindframe, National Media and SANE, Council Chair Julian Disney says the revised set of standards relating to suicide when covered in the media have been a long time coming. A lot of the recommendations, such as adopting caution in phrasing and terminology when publicising what is known as a standard implication in its reporting of a death without suspicious circumstances, I look into the issue of how much public benefit can come from the reporting of suicide.
Some of the tips we give the media is like, look, you're the wordsmith, details of the method, details of the location, that's going to cause real risk to your viewers. Other things we try to say as well is limit the use of the word suicide, because that can be like a beacon.
As project coordinator for the National Modern Media Initiative, Mark Bryant urges reporters to tread carefully, as slip-ups in reporting on suicide can be almost fatal, as he explains.
This is sort of like an impact a newspaper can have. Particularly if the journalist puts the wrong number, it can have bad consequences. We know from people who survivors of suicide have told us that they've, you know, tried to call a number and it was the wrong number.
Also maintaining a watchful eye on media accountability when reporting on all issues surrounding mental health, SANE is a separate body of the Media Initiative. SANE Chief Research Officer Barbara Hocking.
We want to make sure that any of the reporting that happens does have a positive outcome. If it's such a thing that we can improve services, we can improve support, so we want to make sure that any media coverage contains helpline numbers so that anyone who's reading a story or listening to the story does get some information about where they could get help if they felt they needed it. We also want to make sure that the impact on family and friends is provided, because that can be a very strong deterrent.
Yeah, now some of the terms that are used are quite broad and problematic within themselves. Notions of public interest and newsworthiness, I suppose.
Exactly. These are very difficult terms to define, and certainly I don't think these guidelines mean that every single suicide needs to be reported. Now, every suicide is an absolute tragedy for the person, their family and friends, but it is not always in the public interest to hear about every single suicide. One thing we want to guard against is that people in the community hear the word so often that they become immune to it, that they cease to then feel that this is an important issue. We don't want vulnerable people to think that because many, many people are dying from suicide that it's an okay thing to do. So there's a very fine line that we tread between raising the issue as an important issue, and it is very important, but also not talking about it so often that it starts to be something that people cease to care about.
the biggest thing I would think would be the media that you're unable to control, such as YouTube. There was a suicide pact between two teenage girls a few years back, and I wonder whether that kind of glorifies that notion in a way that is uncontrollable.
Exactly. No, look, excellent point, because that's the other thing we really must be very, very conscious to avoid, is glorifying, sensationalizing these events. They are anything but worthy of that. They're very great tragedies for the person concerned and for their family and friends, and we must avoid giving any details that might put ideas into someone who's indeed thinking of taking action.
Determined not to let this tragic event occur in vain, Gavin Larkin is the founder of the new and slightly more online savvy initiative called Are You OK Day, which is specifically about suicide awareness.
I lost my father to suicide in 1995, and I wanted to do something that honoured his life and the kind of bloke he was. And I also wanted to do something that made a difference, to help with a problem that the more I found out about, the angrier I got. You know, we've got a huge suicide problem, and it's something that needed to be done.
And it's also improved from the past notions that the public inherently kept all these kind of issues hush-hush.
For many years, the media, this was an off-limits subject, and I strongly believe that that's contributed to the taboo nature of it. And while you could always argue that people are at risk by any conversation of suicide taking place, the vast majority of people will be positively influenced if we can get a less stigmatised and more empathetic and broader, you know, knowledge-based appreciation of the subject.
So does the good outweigh the bad? According to the likes of Larkin, it certainly does. Bottom line is, how much do we need to have, the reports of someone who takes their own life? Is it necessary to be documenting all these cases, or should we just be incorporating, you know, these ideas and these kind of prevention methods?
For many years, people have not wished to talk about it for many different reasons. But certainly, the media has been talking about it more recently than ever before. And there's been a media monitoring study done that showed that in the last 10 years there's been a major increase in the number of stories written about suicide. And very encouragingly, better quality stories are being prepared. So media have been doing a better job long before these guidelines have appeared. These guidelines now will help give media professionals even greater confidence that the way they're going to go about the reporting is going to be safe and going to be helpful. We want to make sure we talk about suicide as an issue rather than each and every individual suicide, because we do know that by providing details of the method, location, that can be very counterproductive. We do know that providing helpline numbers, the context for the story and the impact on family and friends can be helpful. We want to make sure we get more stories like that. So it is an important issue to be discussed. We must make sure that it's done safely and responsibly in the media. And if we all work together on that, with good media reporting, with good targeted activities for people who are at high risk, we should be able to reduce the numbers of people who die by suicide every year.
SANE Chief Research Officer Barbara Hocking, ending that report about how the media should deal with the issue of suicide. If you ever need to talk to someone, give Lifeline a ring on 131 114, as well as accessing some of the amazing resources available online from sane.org. Across community radio, you're tuned into the Fourth Estate. I'm Meg Caldwell. The Media Entertainment and Arts Alliance, or MEA, has sent letters to Australian government ministers after journalists raised concerns about gaining access to Australian detention centres. Alliance members complained about requests for access and how they are continually denied, as well as banning TV cameras from such facilities. MEA claimed that the private contractor running these detention centres, Serco, sees the presence of journalists as posing a critical threat. The ABC recently published a report on the suicide of 41-year-old detainee Ahmed Al-Akabi at Sydney's Villawood Detention Centre. And Nathan Coates caught up with the journalists behind the report, Joel Keep and Alexandra Vaughan, about the experiences of gaining access into the centre, as well as reporting on this story.
the people we spoke to, they found him hanging, and they tried to prevent him from breaking his neck or from suffocating or what usually occurs when you hang yourself, and they held him up in an attempt to do that, and one of their number ran to get the guards. The guard came back to the side of the hanging, and they implored the guard to cut him down, but the guard either would not or could not improvise and didn't have a sharp implement at the time.
What device did the detainees use to attempt to bring Mr. Kirby down from the rope?
Well, when they realised that the guard was not willing to improvise with some sort of sharp instrument, they got out a cigarette lighter and they burnt down the rope.
In terms of getting access to Villawood Detention Centre, can you tell us a bit about the process you went through and ultimately how you got in?
Yeah, well, initially I got into contact with the Refugee Action Coalition, and they put me in contact with an Iranian activist, and then he was the one who took us out to Villawood, and we pretty much pretended to be visitors. We didn't declare ourselves as journalists at the time. Given the media restrictions there, you can't go as a journalist.
Adding to that, though, the only way in which we didn't declare ourselves was to the company Serco themselves. The detainees were well aware that we were journalists. The people that we spoke to were well aware of our role and also aware that we weren't activists of any kind and we weren't, you know, pushing an agenda. We were quite transparent in that sense. The only thing that was, I suppose, comes under maybe some people would consider it hazy ethical grounds is the fact that we didn't declare ourselves as journalists to Serco.
How did that make you feel, having to, you know, employ some tactics in order to get in? Did that leave you feeling dishonest or at risk?
Well, I always assumed it was what we were meant to do. I mean, there really was no other option left. We tried to approach the Department of Immigration through the normal channels, and they said that they don't facilitate media access to detention centres, so there really was no other option left.
Joel, you mentioned the Privacy Act was brought up.
Oh, that was with regards to questions we put to DIAC regarding a Tamil detainee. The Department of Immigration and Citizenship says that they can't comment on individual cases due to the Privacy Act, and they're obliged to protect the privacies of all individuals involved in the detention system. But we told them that this individual had waived their right to privacy and they had no privacy concerns. Regardless, DIAC still cited the Privacy Act, and they appear to be using the Privacy Act as a suppressive tool. So it's really not the privacy of the individuals they have as their primary concern. It's really a means of restricting information.
I understand the Privacy Act is principally concerned with governing the collection, storage, use and disclosure of personal information. So it's primarily used for government agencies, banks and the like, in terms of protecting people's personal information. Given that detainees can decide what they tell a reporter, they can govern their own privacy, why do you think officials would cite the Privacy Act?
I think it's difficult to provide speculation on that kind of a decision, because it is, I mean, purely coming from us, it is speculation and, I suppose, in our case, strong suspicion. But, I mean, there has been for a number of years, and if you look even within the legal system, there have been, for a number of years, issues with transparency of these detention centres. I mean, even going back to Woomera days, I mean, it's been a continual issue. I mean, things got better, don't get me wrong, but I think that there is this, you know, private move to privatise this particular area, move to offshore processing, and it just gives a sort of greater control for the government of that particular area of policy, I suppose.
The Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance has sent letters to Australian government ministers after journalists raised concerns about gaining access to Australian detention centres. Do you think it's time that guidelines are re-examined for journalists accessing detention centres and detainees?
Yeah, definitely. I think that we do in general. I mean, looking from a journalistic perspective, and actually Wendy Bacon in a forum the other night regarding Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks brought up the point that I suppose freedom of information in Australia is far inferior than our other sister Western countries, I suppose, like the US. We have a really poor track record of allowing journalists access to information and also access to premises where they can, you know, have access to information in order to put it out into the public arena. Because I think in that sense, you can't purely rely on the government issuing press releases about what's going on or issuing their own information about what's going on, because you need someone independent and that sort of accountability mechanism. So definitely, yeah, I'd say that it does need to be re-examined, particularly with this issue, though.
Yeah, most definitely. I think things need to be reconsidered. The whole culture of secrecy surrounding the detention system is going to be something that future generations will reflect on poorly. Most of the people we spoke to, I mean, pretty much everyone we spoke to inside, said they'd never spoken to a reporter. And some of those people have been in detention for a year and a half.
Something that really stood out.
Yeah, some of them longer.
Do they want to talk to reporters?
Yes, they were dying to speak to someone. They want their stories to be heard. And we were speaking to these people for 5-6 hours on end some days. And they've been asking us, where is the media?
The MEAA claims the private contractor running some detention centres, Serco, now includes the unauthorised presence of journalists in its list of critical threats. As journalists, how does this make you feel?
Oh, that's actually a funny story, because that was actually released on the same day that our story was published.
Are you responsible for...
Who knows? It coincided, let's just say that much. Look, it gives me a giggle, to be honest.
I think it was in the Telegraph, no less, on the very same day we were published, or the next morning.
Yeah, it was the morning that we were published. The Daily Telegraph basically reprinted a press release that was obviously, released by Serco.
Do you think you're each critical threats?
Coming from our background, yeah, definitely.
I don't mind being put up there with a car bomber.
I mean, the main thing, you know what the great thing is about it, despite the fact that it's kind of comical in a way to suggest that we are a threat in that kind of a sense. Although I suppose, we were telling a story that they didn't have control over, and it was within, it affects their interests. So, what the great thing about it for us, I suppose, I don't know whether Joel agrees with me, I hope he does, is that we got a response. And the fact is that, we'd been struggling to tell this story since December last year when we started on it, and got frustrated that no one was really taking an interest in the story that we wanted to tell. And obviously, after finally getting published, we got some kind of a response.
Speaking to Nathan Coates, Joel Keep and Alexandra Vaughan braved the barricades of Villawood Detention Centre and reported on the issues that most often get gagged. The government has introduced a number of policies, including the Australian Broadband Guarantee and Closing the Gap, ensuring that online technologies will be accessed within the most remote Indigenous communities. But a new study has found a number of challenges in accessing the internet, potentially compromising the community in terms of health and education. The study by the Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne, alongside the Centre for Appropriate Technologies, or CAT, looked at internet knowledge and usage in 3 central Australian outstations. The findings reveal that while most people are keen to access online technologies, only about 6% on average had regular access to a computer, with many struggling even to access phone coverage. Associate Professor at Swinburne, Ellie Rennie, says a number of key issues need to be addressed, including affordability, education, and infrastructure.
I was doing other research at the time into the remote Indigenous broadcasting sector, and I met up with the CAT researchers while I was there just to discuss some of the inconsistencies of policy for provision of internet in remote communities. So we started to think about, well, why isn't there home internet in many Indigenous communities? Why aren't households taking up internet in the way that the mainstream population is? And that's kind of where the research question started. So, I mean, affordability was the main issue identified in remote communities around why they didn't have computers and the internet. But there were also other, I suppose, more complex issues in that 60% of people in the study had never even used the internet. So there was a big issue just around knowing what type of internet is available where you live, the technical knowledge to be able to liaise with the providers. we were asking people, how do you find out something like, you know, if the road is open or the footy scores? And most of the time that either involves driving somewhere where you can get mobile phone reception or climbing a water tower to get mobile phone reception. It's just done through networks of friends and family and people traveling around. But that is a very slow process.
You kind of came along with the most robust communications device in a two-way radio, because basically in one of the communities the payphone was broken and there's no real phone coverage. That to me just sounds almost primitive.
The most poignant moment of the study for me was when we were asked by one community if they could use our radio to dial a hospital because a relative had just had an operation. We learned that he's had his leg amputated, and you know, that kind of brought home how difficult it is just to even know if someone has survived an operation when you need to know. In that particular instance, we were lucky we had the car radio, but for most of the time that form of communication is not available if the phone is not working.
But you also used that as an example of why e-health plans and the like would be very beneficial in these communities as well.
Broadband could be of incredible benefit in these communities. That was a need that they identified themselves. In one of the communities, I was talking to the old women, and one of them said, my sister's living in town because she needs to be able to access medical services, and she calls me and I can't get to the phone in time because it's, you know, 20 or 30 metres away from her house. And so they were kind of talking about just very basic communication needs, daily needs, that could really be partially or probably completely resolved through basic internet access, in that she might have been able to use Skype, for instance, if there'd been an internet connection in the community. There was certainly a desire for internet access.
How much of a sense of remoteness was there for you? Did you feel like suddenly you didn't exist because you weren't kind of switched on in that sense? Did you kind of wonder, you know, where what was happening and where life was at?
Yeah, I mean, look, you do get a sense of isolation in remote communities. I mean, it's a sense of geographical isolation. I mean, they're certainly not social isolation in that they have, you know, very, very strong kinship networks and the like.
But I guess, you know, that just, kind of taking for granted, you can always have an email or a text or a Facebook update, and you can always know what's going on in your world.
It's certainly a different communications environment to what we're used to. And, you know, we talk about the benefits of broadband and super fast fibre to the home and new e-services and applications. But these small remote Indigenous communities, it's very hard to just be able to contact friends or family or a nurse when you need to.
Some of the findings from the research indicate a lot of very common problems that we're all experiencing, because we don't really know what's going on at the moment. We're all in a bit of a wait-and-see period. I mean, there are promises by the government about a broadband guarantee program. Is there any guarantee, do you think?
There are other studies that have been done, which is, I mean, not to the same extent, but I identified similar issues with, say, the take-up of the NBN in Tasmania, where people just might not have the digital literacy or technical knowledge required to be able to say that the NBN is my preferred technology or not, to be able to make the informed decision affected. There is no broadband guarantee, but the reasons are much more complex than the infrastructure. The Australian Broadband Guarantee has now changed since we did that study to the interim satellite scheme run by the NBN Co. Still a similar subsidy of the hardware and installation costs of satellite internet. But yeah, that's correct. There is no guarantee when the other factors in place, such as basic communication access, such as telephones, or the ability to kind of understand what kind of connection you need. So the message of the study is that no matter how good the infrastructure is, take-up still needs to be looked at as a serious issue, particularly for remote communities who have the most to gain from broadband in many respects, because their basic communication infrastructure is so low and because they're living in places where it's very difficult to access services and information. So we do hope that this will enable some kind of policy outcome in the long term, where government funding was being directed towards shared internet access facilities in larger communities, and that the smaller Indigenous communities, called outstations or homelands, were really left out of that policy, and that it's a policy that couldn't necessarily cater to those communities. Simply, it would be inefficient. You couldn't keep them maintained or supervised when there are over 1,100 Indigenous communities. We're hoping that will inform government policy. We do have the Department of Broadband on our reference committee, and they're very interested in this project and working with us.
Swinburne University's Associate Professor Ellie Rennie, and do check out cat.org.au to find out what the Centre for Appropriate Technologies is doing to help close the gap. Online opinion sites and other public forums are tentatively moving towards ending anonymous commentary. A rising number of personal attacks and even threats cause sites to consider the move in an attempt to curb a trend of ferocious comments targeted at journalists and public figures as well as other individuals. The idea, which has been considered by sites as the ABC's Drum and News Limited's The Punch, is in no way unique. Facebook marketing director Randy Zuckerberg, who recently quit, called for an end to online anonymity, saying it would force internet users to act more responsibly. However, others have defended this notion of being anonymous online, arguing it's an important tool to enable freedom of speech. Dylan Barber spoke to Dr. Karen Brooks, Associate Professor of Media Studies at Southern Cross University.
The internet provides a previously unparalleled venue for debate on all manner of topics, and even provides an avenue for freedom of speech that, you know, circumvents censorship and oppression in all parts of the world. So on one hand, you've got anonymity as an important part of social and indeed global dynamics. However, on the other hand, it has this capacity to undermine the very ethos of healthy informed debate. What are your thoughts on this dichotomy, and do you believe online anonymity has a place in today's culture?
Yeah, I think they're great questions, and I think you're absolutely right. I think it polarises the whole issue, the idea of online anonymity. And it's a tool, I guess. If we consider it a tool, it's how that tool's used and the hands that wield it, how it comes across. So, as you said, on the one hand, it's a wonderful tool to fight against depression and silencing, that people can feel free to express how they really feel.
Yeah. Now, in public forums and online arenas, anonymous comments allow people to freely express racism, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia, hate and brutality, and this sort of, I guess it's a hit-and-run type of criticism with no consequences. And undoubtedly, these are a minority of people, but they aren't being held accountable. What does this lack of accountability say? It's not so much about them, but about us.
Yeah, I think it's really problematic, and I don't think that as a society, we've come such a long way, and increasingly we're being challenged to broaden the way we think, to broaden the way we look at people. We're invited to look at difference and express tolerance and understanding most of the time, and we do that, and we do that very well here in Australia, to a civil society. And the sad thing about it is it's often an expression of fear of difference and fear of all those things. And it's not informed. It's prejudicial. It doesn't contribute anything to the debate or to us as a society. And in fact, what it does is undermine democracy in so many ways and undermine free speech, because I find it really problematic. People who say, well, I'm just being honest. No, you're not. You're being offensive and hurtful and, hateful. And I really find it unfortunate that these wonderful avenues, social media and things like that, have allowed these people to have such free rein.
You talked about people defending their right to express themselves. What is your response to people who defend online anonymity with the argument of freedom of speech?
Yeah, look, I'm all for freedom of speech too, but I think you are free to attack arguments. You are free to express how you feel about particular ideologies. What I don't think you are free to do, and this is again about civility, manners and respect, is to disrespect, is to offer personal comments. It's called an ad hominem attack when you attack the person and not their argument or their position. And we can talk about anyone from politicians to journalists who have columns or write a story about a particular person, and even reality TV contestants. There are very personal, horrible, unbelievable comments proffered about these people who, are human beings with families, friends, lovers that also read these comments. And, that is not productive. That is not useful. That's just, again, hateful. And the sad thing is that these types of comments seem to feed on each other. And it's like cyber peer pressure. They encourage others to come forward and also offer hateful comments. And when anyone dares to say, hey, hang on a minute, do you realise what you're doing here? This is really, really awful. Yeah. Then that person's yelled at, in cyberspace and silenced for daring to criticise these awful people.
You talk about the personal insults and that having no place, but there is a level of, there are death threats and physical threats sometimes, especially for journalists and other public figures who are open to criticism because they're out there for public scrutiny. How responsible do you think anonymity is for people making these sort of threats? Because I imagine many of these people wouldn't make the same threats face-to-face or if they knew they could be held accountable.
I think it's absolutely responsible for it, and that's why I think it's really, really sad, because on the one hand, as you said earlier on, as we both said, anonymity can be a very powerful, freeing thing. But when it frees people to be abusive and make threats that in any other forum and indeed face-to-face, one, wouldn't be made, and two, would be grounds for legal action, then we have a real problem. You know, it's like that old saying, if you're not prepared to say it to my face or not prepared to, own the words, don't say them. And yet the number of people who feel that it has freed them to become these vicious, threatening, abusive people is just unbelievable. And I mean, I cited recently what happened to Mia Friedman, with her column, but it happens all the time. And I think the general public would be quite horrified if they saw what people who are out, put their voices and opinions and various things out there on a daily basis, just what they are subjected to. And seriously, since we've had online media, it's become worse. There were always the snail mail respondents who would, I guess, put forward false names and offer threats. But now that it's so easy to do that, it's just amazing how much there is out there. But again, they are in the minority, and that's something that I guess we have to be relieved about.
Yeah. Now, you of course held an online discussion on this topic, and I noted one person questioned how people are meant to follow standards online when watching, for example, Parliament Question Time was like watching an Animal Planet mudslinging match. Do our leaders deserve some of the responsibility?
Look, I think that the difference with Parliament is that they do face each other when they offer the mudslinging, and often they walk away and shake hands. So there is a degree of respect among the disrespect. And look, I think what makes a really healthy society is informed, vigorous, humorous, and sometimes rude debate. There's no doubt about that, and nobody wants to discourage that. And that's the difference between what happens in Parliament, when it's sitting or whenever, and politicians, that they will put their face and their name to the words that they say about anyone. But it is these faceless cowards that hide behind their keyboard and their consoles, and screens, that aren't prepared to do that. And they're the ones that really what they contribute is in the end meaningless. It doesn't offer anything of value except to demean and diminish what we try to do as a society.
Yeah. Now, arguably, anonymity is an entrenched part of the internet that will always exist. What do you think needs to be done to bring a balance between, the positive facilitation of public discussion and debate and the trend of, mudslinging criticism and threats?
Yeah, look, I wish I had the answer for that. And all I can offer, I guess, is when it does happen, is that people, I guess when they're putting their opinions up too, is say something to the person before them that's done the mudslinging and the hateful comments. Say, hey, that's not necessary. No doubt they'll be attacked too. But I think if we keep sort of pointing out that type of thing's not appropriate, then and we don't accept it, and I guess call them to account by saying, what's your name and what are you doing there, it might pull them back. And that, I think, is the only way we can do this, because, as you said, I think anonymity will always be there. And look, I wouldn't want to take it away, but I would want to curb the negative side of it.
That was Dr. Karen Brooks of Southern Cross University, speaking there with the Fourth Estate's Dylan Barber. And that brings us to the end of another edition of the Fourth Estate. Big thanks to the financial support seen by the Humanities and Social Sciences Department at the University of Technology Sydney and Macquarie University's Faculty of Arts. Do catch up with us online. Go to our website, 4thestateradio.blogspot.com. So until next week, my name's Meg Caldwell. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and I'll catch you again next time here on the Fourth Estate.